Bank Session Number 11938, Reel 33.
Mr. G. Eyston, Reel 33. The Royal Artillery Officer, Mr. Eyston, what was his response to your action over the 25-pounder?
Well, he'd already taken some barracking from the back of the truck, I think, when he'd tried to do it. And I think when he saw the state that I was in, I was furious. Make no mistake, I was furious, and could easily have got the blows. I don't think I would have done, actually, but I was in that sort of state. I was worn out. And I knew there was tanks on the top. I knew there was guns behind us. I knew there was something happening in front of us. And the sea on the other side. So it wasn't a very pleasant situation to be in. And I knew I had a slipping clutch. And I went out and I talked to him. And he knew he was pushing his luck. You know, I mean, he realised he was really pushing his luck. But an artillery officer didn't like to leave a gun behind. I must be fair, he put a good case. But in my opinion, men will always come before guns when it's in a situation where it's one or the other. And that's the situation it was in. Because if I... Well, the gun, he wouldn't have pulled it. I don't think I'd have even shifted it. Not with the men I had in the back, anyway. If I chucked all the men off and made them march, maybe. But I don't think that was a good thing to do, because... we're better having them all together than setting them off on their own, which was the instruction later on, funnily enough. Make your own way to Tobruk. I don't know how we got it, but that was the instruction we got, was get to Tobruk and start again from there, which we thought would happen.
What state and condition were the men in that you were picking up?
Dejected. I would say. Mad. Fighting mad. You see, a lot of them, particularly our own lads, this had happened to them before. And they didn't like it. Through no fault of their own again. I mean, for weeks in the box, well, for the 3 weeks that the battle was going on, we were convinced we were on top. We were just waiting to do a front attack and push the armour through and go and surround him, you know, and really shoot him up. And to this day, we still really don't know why that didn't happen. As I've said before, we weren't allowed to take a tank out on the west side of the box, which just doesn't make sense as far as we can see.
Was there any anger towards officers, particularly commanding officers, at this point?
Not to commanding officers, I don't think. No. No, I don't think there's any badness towards... Not local commanding officers. Certainly, there was a feeling that something was wrong on top. Because... There was mixed feelings, you see. We'd got this new tank, the Grant, which appeared to be a good tank. But for the Grant to fire its gun, it was 4 feet above what the German tank would be. So it was, if it wanted to fire its heavy gun in any sort of anti-tank situation, it stuck out of the ground a mile, with it not having a gun in the turret. You see, not having a good gun in the turret. And it was obvious that that wasn't going to go, because as soon as that the turret that was on appeared above the ground, they put the 88mm guns onto it, and that was the end of the Grant. It was a good tank. If it had been used as a means of taking artillery forward, but as an armoured vehicle, fighting an armoured vehicle, it really wasn't done. Which was when we found out later. I mean, when we saw this tank, we thought we'd got the world. And I explained some tapes ago about being out in the front with Bill Handel and watching the tank battle going on. And we could see then what was happening, because they would have to expose themselves before they could bring the gun into action in an anti-tank situation, in a tank-to-tank situation. So there was great disappointment because we'd seen these brand new tanks. They did look good to us, but then we realised that they weren't as good as we thought they were.
Was there any a panic from men around you that were wanting to get away irrespective of discipline or anything else?
Well, when we got further on, you see, there was this thing about get to Tobruk. And there was a little panic there, I think, really, because it was suggested Tobruk was round the corner. They didn't say Tobruk was 16 miles round the corner. Tobruk was round the corner and out to sea, and round the corner you're in Tobruk. But it was 16 miles round the sea when into Tobruk.
Was the order then basically that when you got to the bottom of the escarpment up the coast road, this came down, just get into Tobruk?
That was more or less what the situation was, yes. It didn't exactly say you're under your own steam, but I'd been used to more or less travelling under my own steam. And the bunch were on the back. They weren't all 6th Battalion lads. I mean, I just said we had RA, we had engineers. I believe there's two machine gunners. Where we got them from, I just don't know, but I believe there's two machine gunners. And there, possibly, there were, but I was going to come to that one, and I'll come to that one in a minute or two. Because that is in the battle itself, and I want to try and explain my feelings at that time. It's a bit difficult, really. But we did pick all the men up, but the gun, I'm afraid, we left behind. We took the sights, I think, and I don't know whether we took the block. Anyway, we took whatever we could. Which, again, the heavy pieces, if you take a bit of a gun, it's a very heavy piece. Which, again, overloaded the vehicle quite considerably. Now, so we carried along the coast road and eastwards. And then we could hear this battle in front of us getting really, really naughty. In fact, as we got coming out of the valley between the sea and the escarpment into this sand dune situation, which I've tried to, it's hard to display. It's still higher ground on your right as we were going down, but nothing like an escarpment. You could see. As we're getting down there, there's a 25-pounder, or maybe 400 yards away to the right. And it's really thumping out on open sights, rapid fire on open sights. So we knew there was something seriously going on. There was our 1-2-pounders on the portees. They were pumping out whatever they could. There's machine guns and there's rifle shot. And all that rapid fire, they were really giving it hell. And the officer, because George Adams had got in the back to let the officer sit in the front, he said, make for the 25-pounder. No, the 25-pounder was well sighted on the highest ground that there was around. He was well sighted, and he was really pumping lead out. Well, it's not lead with a 25-pounder, but he was pumping shot out. And it meant that to get to it, we'd got to cross all this fire that was coming towards us. Our own fire coming towards us. And just as we turned, sort of got clear of the escarpment, here's more 10 or 12 tanks mowing down to us off the escarpment. So we're in between the tanks and our own, the 2-pounders and the rifles and machine guns, and we're in the level of the captain's telling me to cut across the 25-pounder. Well, I know that. That's a little bit mad, I thought, but I thought, well, I better be as odd as this now. I've already put him down with not bringing his gun. I thought I'd better head towards it. And I did. We carried on. I suppose, really speaking, but by doing that, we stopped a lot of fire from going back. We got halfway towards the 25-pounder when somebody in the back shouted, "We've been hit." We were still travelling at that time, but I had been in bottom gear for a long time over the rough country to try and get to this 25-pounder. Eventually the clutch passed up altogether and the lads jumped off, and somebody said to Brooks, just round the corner. And a lot of them just scarpered round the corner and off. Now, George Adams, he had been hit. He had blood on his face and his shoulder, and I think he was hitting the leg as well. He certainly was limping. And he was wanting to be round the corner as well, so I left the truck and went with him. I left everything again. Just like France, even my KD shirt, my khaki drill shirt. We left the lot. And we got round the corner into the sea, round the little, I suppose you'd call it a little cliff, not very much of a thing, but a little cliff. And then we came back onto the...
So you'd wade into the sea?
Wade into the sea and round this little thing, and came back onto dry land when we could. I suppose we're in the sea for, maybe a mile. It was quite a... You know, when they said this to Brooks just round the corner, I thought we were round this little knob and we're in the brook. It was 16 miles to go.
So you left the battle behind you?
I left the battle then, yes. Now, what had happened apparently was that the 9th Battalion had run into the 15th Panzer at this place by Elm Rasus, which was a good place for Roman to get. As I said, it was ideal. He hadn't to get down any escarpment. It didn't matter about any passes or anything like that. Passes are always difficult for anybody to attack. You'll have heard about the Alfire Pass the year previous, which had cost dearly on both sides. A pass is always a bad place to go, and Rommel had bypassed all the passes along the escarpment and took this. He'd read his map, which I've tried all over to get hold of a map of the area, and the only one I've seen, in fact, is a German map. So it's difficult. I don't honestly think that we had many maps. If we're going anywhere, we're told to go to a point. They might give us the compass bearing from a gap in the minefield to that point. And I mean, once, if you were about 20 yards out, you could still see the point, because it was, as I did say, about B-12 and 15. They were 40-gallon drums with a mark on the top. It might be a burr or a well. It might be a little tor, like a little hill, or it could be a cairn. There are lots of cairns on the desert, stone cairns, you know, where they've heaped, I suppose the nomads did it. They would heap stones up to make a, just like we have over the North York moors. I can't remember seeing a map on the desert. And all I've seen of positions on the desert, they've been on traces, which are obviously tracing off a map, and then the details filled in on the trace. Whether there were a lot of maps or not, I don't know. Maybe they're all handed in for somebody else. But obviously there were maps, but very, very few, not the way that it's done in a normal country situation where you've got churches and all the rest of it marked. I mean, there's no churches right enough. And I can't remember seeing many maps, and I've looked since. Because to try and describe this escarpment, it's difficult. And I have looked for maps, I just kind of...
What had happened to the rest of the column that you were with, Mr. Eisen, at this stage?
Well, the 9th Battalion had got held up by the 15th Panzer Divisions, and Major Slight, who was leading one of their columns, had put his men into the sand dunes, because it was easier for the infantry to fight through the sand dunes than it was to anything else. So they went in there, and they had a bayonet battle in the sand dunes, and they did more or less get a road through. And then some more infantry, German infantry, came on the scene and fastened them down. And Major Slight at that stage said that he broke up into little groups of a section at a time and said that you've got to try and, you're on your own. You sit where you are for now, but when I give the order, you're on your own, you make your own way to Tobruk. Now, I must be fair about this, that I didn't get that order from Major Slight because I'd never even seen him. But the same sort of suggestion had been given to us. So whether it had come from Colonel Percy with the other Ninth Battalion column or where it came from, I don't know. But there was certainly said, you're on your own, get to Tobruk, which we tried to do. Now, with our own column, Major Ferns had caught up with the 9th Battalion who were doing battle with the Germans on the east side, or the west side of the German roadblock, trying to get through the roadblock, and Major Ferns sent the carriers in, our 6th Battalion carriers, and they did get a road through and allowed part of the 9th Battalion to get through. Our own two founders, the two porties I mentioned, they were firing back west at the tanks coming in from the west with the 125 pounder. Now, the one thing I can't recall, I've tried hard, I'm nearly certain the 25 pounder that was attacking the tanks, they put seven out of action, or between them they put seven tanks out of action, the rest just went back. He was South African. Now, whether this officer was part of the South African coming out of the north box, because we definitely had any 25 pounds with us, and I don't think the 9th Battalion had either. I can't remember seeing artillery on the with the 9th Battalion. There might have been, but you see, when we were on top of the escarpment, we could see pretty well all around. It was a mass of trucks, really, all waiting to get down these passes. So we could see pretty well around us, but I don't recall any 25 pounders. So there was this one 25 pounder who was South African, and he did a marvellous job. He was actually, there's a bit of a story goes to it, that the 25 pounder was being escorted by a South African armoured car, and some of the lads had tried to get this 25 pounder swung round to fire at the tanks that were coming down. But the armoured car commander didn't seem to be very interested, which rather shakes me. You know, you've got to wonder about the story, actually, because the armoured cars were most obliging. As far as we were concerned, anyway, they were most obliging. But he wasn't having much to do with this, bringing his 25-pound into action. And then suddenly, out the base of the armoured car, the voice comes up and says, "I've got a bloke called Percy on the set." And Colonel Percy, by some means, had got onto the same frequency as the armoured car. And he'd used a bit of Geordie language, I believe, and eventually the 25 pound was put into action. Just this one 25 pound. And, I mean, if it hadn't, there's no telling. We wouldn't have been, I wouldn't have been here, I don't think,
so
anyway.
Your column was getting ploughing through, walking through.
Major Ferns had made a gap with his 25 pounders, and the South African 25, sorry, the Major Ferns had got a gap with his carriers, because as I've said, he had quite a few by this time. And the 25 pounder and our anti tank guns had sorted the tanks out. We're still having a problem from artillery, because the artillery that had been firing down the coast road, they had now found where we were. The Stukas were still doing a little bit here and there. And then the RA officer was with us. Not the one that I'd picked up, but the RA OP, which travelled with, we'd picked up from the box at Strickland Post, I think it was. Strickland Post or Ambulance Post, I forget what now. He got in touch with the RA who were in Tobruk. Not quite, well, on the perimeter. And they fired over 3,000 yards, and they put a lot of their German artillery out. So then apparently they got peaceful, but I mean, when I left, it was anything but peaceful. And George was in a pretty bad state, and I don't know whether Jack Foster was with me at this time or not. There was three of us anyway, and we managed to get George round the corner. And we walked into Tobruk and took George into the hospital. I never saw him anymore. He survived, but I never saw him anymore after dropping at the Tobruk Hospital. And we were still thinking, you see, Tobruk was going to be a safe haven at this stage. We had no intention of stopping there, but we did have a... we got a feed anyway. And then we went down...
Had you any feelings going into Tobruk and being in Tobruk that things might be different, might be disastrous?
No. No, at this stage, I mean, we thought it was a safe haven, just like it had been before. And we knew that Rautmiddel was pretty well spent by this time because he'd... we thought he was, let's put it that way, because we thought we had the better of him before we left Gazala.
So when you're in Tobruk and you see that you've got a food, what was your next move?
Well, we had a rest in Tobruk, and I think we went up to the Nafi, which is across the ridge I was talking about, and then up the other side about... there's a very big Nafi there. And we've been there for a while. We'd left George in the hospital. And then we found out that we must have caught up with Mickey Ferrans again somewhere, or with his group. We must have hitched a lift with some of them. Because we got out to Bertolata, which is way outside Tobruk. Almost to the... Well, I think it was on the... No, it was almost to the boundary. And we joined up with a battalion there. And we were all very, very happy to be there. Because we hadn't seen the battalion then for about 5 days, if I remember rightly. About 5 days since we'd seen the battalion. We're just settling down nicely with the battalion, sort of, I'd got another truck and we're working our way around properly. We're heading for Mirza Matru. Just before we left, while we're still building ourselves up, I was called up to the battalion office and there's me 30 hundredweight. Nothing in it, just a bare 30 hundredweight. Major in English and Captain Runciman from the QM. And I got a real good dressing down for leaving the truck, almost called a deserter. Which I was no way deserting, really. I mean, my instructions were to get to Tobruk, and I must admit I had no intention of being taken prisoner, killed or wounded, maybe, but I had no intention of being taken prisoner. That's always been a fear, that I'd be a prisoner. Because that is one thing I don't think could really have stood. Hospitals or death, that was one thing, but to be taken prisoner, I don't think I could have coped with that. So I got a real good dressing down over this, leaving this vehicle, and for all I complained that it had no clutch or anything like it, it was still... Well, I left a running vehicle, I suppose. And that was it. So I asked about all the things that were on the back, and they said, well, these are the things on the back that have got the truck. So well, my things were taken by Italians, and then it was recovered, and again, and I don't know. I don't know what happened. But the truck came back.
In your situation, a fitter and so on, mechanic, that there was an offence to leave a truck that could be moved.
Could be moved, yes. Could be run. Leaving a truck for the enemy, that was the thing. Now then, to clear myself, I must say that I was told that we'd been hit, and I thought it had been hit. And it stopped running, and I thought, well, that's it. It's had its day. I never expected to see it again. When I did see it again, I was most annoyed that my gear wasn't on, my photos and all my private gear, but I never saw any more of anything of that. Anyway, whether it was an arrangement that I got a good dressing down and that was it, we were no more. I was never charged for anything like that. But I suppose I could easily have been for leaving
their own vehicle. What state was the battalion when you'd rejoined it? What picture did you get of it?
I think it was really happy that it had been rejoined. that there hadn't been a lot of losses for what we'd been through, and the shell fires that had been thrown at us, and all the rest of the rubbish had thrown at us, we were still pretty strong. We'd lost a few carriers here and there, we'd lost a few trucks here and there, but at that stage, from a manpower point of view, we hadn't lost many at all.
Because they'd come out.
They'd come west. Out. I mean, those that went out west and south, they'd hardly lost any. The 8th Battalion had lost one or two, I believe. But the 6th Battalion going out south and west and south, I don't think they'd lost anybody at all. They lost a South African armoured car who was doing escort for them. And I think those two carriers they lost. And they were a truck or two, but they'd hardly lost anybody. So, really speaking, the battalion was in good form, very good form.
And about
but most disappointed that we hadn't done what we thought we were going to do. We'd retreated again. That was what it amounted to. And a battalion never feels happy in a situation like that. It's not supposed to, and it doesn't. I mean, you can say a battalion's not supposed to feel happy when it's retreating, but it doesn't. It's a fact. It doesn't feel happy retreating, and especially when it is not when it's their when it's not their own fault.
About what date did you rejoin the battalion, Mr. Eisen?
Well, I think it was about 5 days from the battalion leaving us at Gazala until we joined up again at Bertolada. So that would make it about the 19th of June, 1942.